Hi, this is Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. We're talking with Bjorn Lomborg. He is the skeptical environmentalist. He's one of the most outspoken people on the planet who is an environmentalist and who believes that much of the environmentalist community is off base. Bjorn, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Paris Climate Accord. Tell us why it's a good thing that the United States has decided to rethink its participation.
So fundamentally, the two things you need to know about the Paris Agreement is, one, it is not going to do very much to tackle climate. So if you look at the UN's own estimate, if everyone had delivered everything they had promised, including Trump and the US, by 2030, the Paris Agreement would have delivered less than 1% of what it's promising. It's a very, very tiny impact on climate.
So it leaves 99% of the problem it says it's going to solve in place.
So the second thing is, it's incredibly costly. It's probably the most costly treaty ever to be signed in history. So if you look at what is the likely cost across the main areas where we have good estimates, it indicates that it's probably around $1 trillion in cost if you do it in the most effective way. That means with carbon taxes in all the relevant regions. And if you don't, which is typically the way you do climate policy, it could easily be $2 trillion. So $1 to $2 trillion a year for the rest of the century, mostly in lost GDP growth. And the net benefit at the end of the century, even if you're very optimistic, will to have been reduced the temperature by about 0.3 degrees Fahrenheit. So spend $100 trillion to achieve virtually no climate benefit. That's a bad deal.
Why Emmanuel Macron, the newly elected president of France, said, hey, you know, there is no plan B for the Paris Agreement because there is no planet B. Assuming that it is a fail, you know, that it will only achieve what you're talking about, is that better than doing nothing?
Well, it depends on what the alternatives are, because you can always say, well, we're doing a little bit. Yes, we know we're wasting an enormous amount of money, but at least we're doing a little bit. Look, that money could have been spent much better at tackling global warming, which is basically about investing in green energy R&D, where we have a severe reduction or underfunding of R&D in many different areas, but that's also true in green energy. And so that is one place where you could spend a lot more. Actually, this has been one of the things that Bill Gates and the Energy Breakthrough Coalition has been working on. And this is something that many governments have even signed up to, partly because of some of the research that we've done showed this is an incredibly effective way to tackle global warming. Fundamentally, instead of trying to make fossil fuels so expensive nobody wants them, which was always going to be politically very hard, try to make green energy, try to innovate green energy to become so cheap, everyone will want them. That's a very effective policy. But the other part of that is, you know, when you're spending $1 to $2 trillion, this would cost perhaps $100 billion, you'd still be left with $1.9 trillion that you could spend on solving all the other issues in the world. It's not like climate is the only thing you need to fix. And so wasting so much money that could have been spent on actually solving real problems for real people, I think is important to recognize as well.
Is it right to say that renewable energy technology, because one of the things, and people like Macron have said this, and a lot of people in the United States, they say, look, the era of renewables are here. It's already cheaper in China to use solar power than coal-based, you know, to generate electricity and whatnot. Is that just wrong? Because you're saying that there's actually a huge amount of research to go and development until renewable, non-carbon-based energy is really ready for prime time.
The unfortunate situation is this is a complicated question to answer very simply. The issue is some places when you put up new solar or new wind, it can actually deliver a kilowatt hour cheaper than, for instance, a new coal-fired power plant. The problem with that argument is it can only deliver it when the sun is shining or when the wind is blowing. If it's not, then suddenly it can't deliver it at any cost. And so the reality is much of the wind and solar that you're talking about is much less worth because you actually have to keep standby options either in terms of batteries or in terms terms of backup operation. And so suddenly that equation doesn't look as simple. But the reality, of course, is if you just look at what the International Energy Agency does, this is on the actual estimate of subsidies. Right now, we're subsidizing solar and wind at the tune of about $125 billion a year. And what they're expecting as we ramp up for the Paris Agreement, they expect that over the next 25 years, we will spend about $3 trillion just in subsidies. And so the simple answer to these people who are saying, oh, green energy is already here, it's cheap, is to say, well, that's wonderful. Then we don't need a Paris Agreement because apparently everybody's just going to switch because it's cheaper. And also, could we have our $3 trillion back, please?
What are some of the other problems that you would prioritize above climate change, or maybe not climate change, but to what are the other issues beyond trying to halt a slow or maybe not so slow increase in world global temperatures that we should be looking at?
So what people generally point out is that global warming is mostly going to hit poor countries. That's because poor countries are typically where it's warmest, and hence increased temperatures are going to hit them hardest. Plus, they also have limited infrastructure to handle temperature rises. But remember, poor countries have lots and lots of other problems. And so the real issue here is we're talking about trying to help poor countries very ineffectively, because we'll only help them a little, and in 100 years, very expensively. When you actually ask poor countries and people in poor countries, what do you want? What do you care about? And the UN did that back in 2015, the biggest survey we've ever done with about 10 million people. And what they told us was, we care about getting education, healthcare, jobs, get rid of corruption, and get food. Those were the top five of 16 opportunities that came out of a UN survey. Across the world, that is what people really care about. And not surprising, you know, when your kids are starving, when they don't get a good education, when everybody has bad healthcare, those are the things that really matter. What came last of these 16 was action on climate change. So very clearly, most people are telling us, which is also in accord with the economic evidence, that if you want to help in the world, climate change is the least effective and the least and the most costly way of helping most of these people first. Now, look, we're an advanced civilization. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. So while we should definitely be spending, I was talking about the $2 trillion that we're going to be spending in Paris every year, we should definitely be spending the $1.9 trillion on all these issues that would help much more effectively right now. But we should also spend perhaps $100 billion a year on investment in green energy R&D. This would be much less than what we're planning on spending on Paris. It would be much less than what we're spending right now on subsidies to ineffective solar and wind. And it would do a lot more good to actually tackle global warming.
And to be clear, you believe that global warming is real, that an average rise in temperatures is happening, that it is an issue, and that human activity is part and parcel of that.
Yes, it's both temperature is rising, human activity is the main cause of this, and it will be in the long run a problem that we should fix.
I think we also need to be
honest about this, that the UN climate panel tells us even in 2070s, when we see 2 degrees temperature rise more than what we have now, and remember those are degrees centigrade, so about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, the net cost of global warming will be somewhere between 0.2 and 2% of GDP. Now, that indicates it's a problem, but it's not the end of the world, as it's often being portrayed. And remember, that means that the problem of global warming over the next 50, 60 years is equivalent to one recession. So it's definitely something we want to avoid, but it's not the end of the world, and it's certainly by no means the most important thing in the world. And that's, of course, also why it ends up at the bottom of the list for the UN priorities.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask, though, because the rhetoric around global warming and the need for action now on the climate is nothing if not apocalyptic. Where is that coming from? Is that coming from just kind of ideological zealots, or is it coming from a misunderstanding of what even the UN science, which is what is constantly being used to buttress the claims that we need to radically transform the way that we produce energy and consume energy and go about our daily lives. Is it that people are mistaken, or are we in the kind of stranglehold of ideological zealots?
I think it's hard to tell, and there's probably a little bit of all of that. So what you just asked was actually also a good example of what happens. You were saying we really radically need to change our civilization. And if you look at what it takes to get to 2 degrees, which is what the Paris Agreement has promised, that is actually true. And that, you know, you can work that out mathematically. If you say 2 degrees is your target, you have to radically change civilization very quickly, get off fossil fuels. And of course, that's going to have huge costs and probably be almost or totally impossible. So that's actually a true statement. But of course, it just reflects the fact that nobody actually in their right minds believe the 2 degree target. It's just something people say because it sounds nice. The other part of it, when people are talking about apocalyptic results, you know, we're going to see more floods, we're going to see more droughts, we're going to see higher sea level rises, more heat waves. It's a combination of stuff that's real and a lot of stuff that's slightly exaggerated. And then the fact that you only look at one thing. You know, if you ask people who work in hospitals, is there an American healthcare crisis? They'll say yes. Should we be spending more money on healthcare? Yes. If you ask teachers in schools, will they say that there's a problem with teaching? They'll say yes, and we should be spending more money on education. Everybody believes their own area is in a crisis, and the problem is that in the climate area, you get so much more attention, and many of these things are just simply tiny truths and a lot of exaggeration. Let me just give you one example. The UN, the UNICEF, which I have a lot of respect for normally, they came out and said, you know, 1 in 4 kids are going to live in countries with very little water. We need to address climate change right now. And there's just so many things wrong in that argument. The main reason why people live in water-stressed countries is because there are more and more people and they use their water resources really badly. We actually know on average you're going to get about the same precipitation, but it's going to be slightly differently distributed, or possibly even more precipitation from global warming. So it's not the global warming thing that we should fix. It's the fact that people don't price water very well and they use it ineffectively. And of course, the whole conceit of saying we're going to try to do something through climate change to help kids not be water stressed in 10 or 20 years is just simply phenomenally off, because whatever we do right now will have absolutely no impact in the next 10 or 20 years of climate change. It's only going to change a little bit, and only in, you know, 80 to 100 years from now. So there's this sense in which you take a little bit of truth and turn it into the end of the world for a variety of different reasons, partly because that's what you mostly focus on, partly because you can't see that there are other ways you could help much more.
How bad is it for people who are environmentalists like yourself and are skeptical of kind of the political consensus on what we should be doing about the environment, particularly global warming, that Donald Trump has emerged as the champion of sanity in saying that the Paris Accord is not worth being part of?
I think it's a hard conversation to have. Because you definitely don't need to agree with everything else Trump has done. I could also imagine that Trump has made this decision on a number of bad arguments. But the fundamental point here is to recognize that if you actually care about the environment, there's a much better way to tackle global warming than the Paris Agreement. Much cheaper, much more effective by focusing on research and development into green energy. And the other thing is to recognize there are much, much more important environmental problems than global warming. If you just take this most incontrovertible indicator, how many deaths do we see from different environmental problems? The UN estimate that we probably see around 141,000 deaths from climate right now, and by 2050, it might be 250,000 deaths. Compare this to the world's by far most deadly environmental problem, which is outdoor air pollution in the industrialized world. It kills about 3.5 million people each year. And indoor air pollution, which is basically poverty in third world countries that you cook and keep warm with really dirty fuels, that kills 4.3 million people each year. So we're talking about problems that are, you know, in the order of 20 times bigger or more then global warming will be even by mid-century, and problems that we could solve much better, much cheaper, much faster, and much more effectively. So there's a double sort of impact. Partly we're not fixing climate change well, partly we're not seeing that there are much bigger environmental problems. And then, of course, the third point that I didn't mention here is, and that's not the environmentalist part, but just if you want to do good in the world, of course, there are many other things, as we mentioned before, getting better education, getting better health care, getting more nutritious food to people. Those are much bigger issues for most people. And again, we can help them much smarter, much more effectively, and actually end up leaving a much better planet.
And that obviously is also part of the work of the Copenhagen Consensus, which you've been putting together, where people with relatively little money come up with really good ideas that have a better cost-benefit ratio than climate change.
Exactly. We work with lots of economists, more than 300 of the world's top economists and 7 Nobel laureates, to try to focus where can you spend a dollar and do the most good. We basically do cost-benefit across all these areas. What we found is that some things for climate are actually really good investment. For instance, stop subsidizing fossil fuels. A lot of people believe that's mostly in the West. It's not. It's, you know, regimes like Venezuela and India and China and Russia, where they subsidize fossil fuels, it gives more congestion, more air pollution, and also more CO2, and it's a bad use of resources. Likewise, invest in green energy R&D. But please don't just do the kind of Paris agreements, which probably has a benefit cost ratio much lower than one. That is, you spend a dollar and you avoid a couple of cents of climate damage. And also then remember that there are many, many other things you can do, both on indoor and outdoor air pollution, but also on these other issues like education, healthcare, nutrition, some of these big issues in the world where you can spend a dollar and do $10, $20, $30 of social good.
Are you optimistic that the conversation about climate change and the need to address the negatives, the externalities of climate change, will move to a more, what you or I might consider a more rational basis, and that instead of talking about all of this as all or nothing and talking about, last night there was much wailing, gnashing of teeth, rending of garments over the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Accord. Do you think we're going to get to a more kind of sober, rational discussion, or is it almost unstoppable to pull things back to having clearer conversations?
I would so much like to be able to say, yes, I am optimistic, but no, I'm not. And I think if anything, we're sort of seeing a replay here of how Kyoto played out. Remember, Kyoto was the solution to global warming back in the 1990s. It was signed by Al Gore, and it was never submitted to ratification in the Senate because they knew it was going to fail. But it was a rallying point for everyone. This is the thing, the treaty that would save the world. By any objective measure, it was an incredibly expensive way of doing almost nothing. So very, very close parallel to Paris. Then George Bush canceled it. And then suddenly everything that didn't work in climate, which is about everything, was George Bush's fault. And I think we're going to see the same thing. It's going to get a lot of people very engaged and excited about we need to do everything we promised in Paris. We're going to waste lots and lots of money. We're not going to achieve our targets. We're not going to make any meaningful dent in actual climate change. And now everyone can say it's Donald Trump's fault. So, the reality is this is a perfect setup for keeping this incredibly partisan. And so in some ways, I see most of the global warming conversation, although a lot of people who are engaged in it actually really do want to do good, a lot of people are also just there to feel good about themselves, which is one of the reasons why you'll drive around in an electric car that gets, $10,000 or thereabouts in subsidies, and yet, perhaps emit 3 tons of CO2, which is probably worth about $15 less. That's just ridiculous. But there's a lot of that kind of stuff. And that is mainly because we're in a situation where this is no longer about doing what's best for the planet, but simply about, aligning yourself with the right and left and feeling good about your own actions.
Well, we will leave it there. We have been talking with Bjorn Lomborg. Bjorn, where is the best place for people to follow you, either on Twitter or on the web?
On Twitter, on Facebook, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm an influencer there. And of course, we have our website, both Lomborg.com, and we're also on CopenhagenConsensus.com, where we work on prioritizing, for instance, Haiti. We just finished a big prioritization there, one for Bangladesh, and many other places where we're trying to, you know, in small measures, try to help people think smarter. I wish we could also do that in climate, but I think we're a little ways away from that.
Well, we will leave it there on that cautionary note. Thank you so much for talking. This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.